Sometimes I write about mice. Sometimes the cats chase the mice, and sometimes the mice chase the cats. And sometimes they eat each other up until there's neither skin, nor bone, nor lung, nor tuft of fur left. That's my little Ars Poetica that opens my previous book, Codes of Public Sleep. And I'm really so excited to be here in my first trip to Ireland, and it's unfortunately all too brief, unfortunately for me, but it's giving me enough of a taste that I'm just really dying to come back and stay a little bit longer. I love it. I actually love it here in Cork so far. It's just a beautiful city. I love the people. I want to read a few of the poems from sonnets. I love writing the short lyric, and it's not quite finished with me left yet, so I've started composing some double sonnets, or they're composing me, and so I'll read a couple of those as well. I think I can leave this behind for now, my honey. I dissipate when you need me most. What am I? I dig in when you most need to be alone with your regret. What am I? Maybe you won't mind if I just leave you clawing the air. What am I? What if I settle in for a while, your worst memory? What am I? Or else I'll morph into you. But what if there's no you? What am I? I just want to preface the next one by saying that I've been really, really interested in reading about cognitive science. It's really informed some of the work that I do. And the 1990s was known as the decade of the brain because the cognitive science were making so many new discoveries about the way that the brain actually works. From the previous vision of the brain, which was very sort of a linear kind of thought process, and there was a sort of a little what they call a homunculus. No doubt some of you have heard of this little, it's a figurative way of imagining the sort of centralized vision of the way that the brain works, and it's always a little man up here for some reason, men or woman, and it's sort of this centralized place where all your perceptions come together, and there's a little, this little homunculus up here is the control panel, the central processing station of the brain. And so I sometimes get into a little dialogue with this homunculus, which the poem explores. I gave you all my sense, blind homunculus, a sea in a sea, but I'm far from broke. Do you love me, zombie? Your main products are indigo, figments, tricks of cardiac debt, and a defiant sponge. Sometimes your vision, fluorescent and copious, undershines the diamonds of your rods and cones, and you have to wriggle your way back, salmon-like, up the information spillage to the enchanted vapor. You preen your molecules, all the while scorning the witness of your proposed gleam. And on your own little hillside, your own fraudulent elsewhere, flashing your mirrors into the sun, you grow roots of endless delay. I'm going to read a couple of poems from a section in a book called Parroted Weeds, and I was experimenting with the idea of repeated words, or a chain of repeated words, which is most obvious in the first one, the process, that is. So many melodies are lost in the time it takes to sing. To sing is to quote a slice of lore's flashy highlights. Into life's lonely dwelling is born a blundering fool. The fool's entranced lion roars a raw, mystic language. in the language of its brand new country, honey means Hamlet. Hamlet is lost in a labyrinth, at the heart of which a velvety orange. Orange is the fervor of the foreign blue night. In the night, the bees buzz. They buzz and buzz, just as birds know bird things. Thing is, you just can't kiss life the way you used to. I used to rock the boat like I now court the lapsed muse of dust. Dust motes and size pressure are beautiful, if not terribly important to them. They can't get you for that, can they? If only memory held the key, its traces were the key to grammar, not yet grammar. If the brute sound waves of jackhammers were a way to witness. The memory of brutes is brutes remembering, or something remembering brutes. Cleaving or cleaving to. Typical, like photographs imagining they capture perfect moods. Just perfect, think the photographs as they capture brute space. They feel limited. If only they had perfect readers to rescue them, though readers are unreliable witnesses. They limit, they garble, they cannot rescue all their moments. At best, they rescue typical memories of random jackhammers and crowds. At best, moments emerge and disintegrate like babbling crowds that are not yet grammar. At best, the crowds are random. If random, then rescue. If rescue, then witness. I'm from New Orleans originally, but I moved up to Toronto from New Orleans in 2005. And I was in the city when Katrina came blowing through. But I like to say this. I'm going to read a poem about Katrina. My first Katrina poem was actually long before Katrina. I had just moved down back to New Orleans from upstate New York, and I was just struck by how wet the place is. New Orleans is just like a sponge. There's swamps everywhere and water and. The place is a bowl, you know, which is why it flooded so horribly. And by the way, I felt a sympathetic connection here in Cork when I found out about the flood, and I just was horrified to see what this happened to such a beautiful city. The poem is called Katrina Tundra. I make up paths that end without warning in the eye of the storm. I know which path to take, but once I start thinking, deciding becomes impossible. On the tundra, old juniper bushes were once juniper berries. I gaze at the news on TV, old enough to bury childish nostalgia, but not too old to cultivate obsessive watching. A child in the public library, I gazed at the yellowing pages of sapphire tundra lakes. I learned of the yellowish waters of the flood. I learned that ptarmigans turn white in winter and gazed at an island afloat in the middle of water shimmering in the wintry sun. In my neighborhood, islands of red ants float in filthy water. I have a king and a queen poem. King. Footfalls on snow pass other footfalls. Inscribed in snow, furrows crisscross the sleeping kingdom. Over sleep's pages creep gambits. In the king's gambit, subjects open their books to a flight of unorthodox birds. The birds announced the untimely demise of the king. It was time, they chirp, for winter. And anyway, what's the matter with bad news? There's cruelty in the pirouettes of tiniest matter. Locks cruelly breed locks. With that, they flit away to their otherworldly nests to breed more discontent in the kingless realm. There's no time for winter, cries the king's ghost as he watches his subjects pass each other in the snow. I really like to watch documentaries. They're sort of nice little, you know, bedtime stories. And especially for some reason, these end time scenarios, you know, the volcanoes and the, you know, meteors, the thing that's going to just, you know, zap the earth and the end of life on earth. It's strangely comforting. Glib Spice announces the news, bleeding in the monochromatic distance. The short-term memory of distance, sleep, and fear. Enemies fall, money flees. Falling gloom dazzles, just as history taught it to. Not the history of stars made of tumbleweed, nor the annals of a dust moat singing rich disaster. Mazach was never so rich, or so it seems to each geological layer. No notebook records a pocket of posies between thick layers of ash. It just is, caught in a small pocket of time. It's time to return to Star, announces Tumbleweed on the news. The news shrinks to a speck of pollen on a posy's anther in a pocket caught between thick layers of ash. My partner told me to read some optimistic poems too. So I'll counter that one with a nice part about springtime. Cold windows quietly hoard iridescent ova, I write, to begin at the brink of something that seems almost attainable. The prospect looms distantly in cool meditation, not about to teeter into the first warm breath to come down the pike and call it home. I've eaten the last morsel and become a stranger to myself, as far away as Orion wheeling slowly across the sky. Plate empty, I dance to conjure melted brook as the unmoved sun massively shrugs off the confabulation of my phantom gestures. I'm already hungry for the freshly eaten feast, but even this early in the game, I feel I must deceive myself as once again synapses conspire to blurt out a raucous draft of blooms. And I'll read one of the poems for this new collection that I'm writing of the double sonnets called The Maddox Slant. Reinventing stairs takes a plot as subtle as dust drifting onto a slope in undecided space. Position is everything. Even the drift of stars implies a story. Gather enough stories, and some get buried forever in urns. Those that surface know that memory and sunlight forever walks hand in hand, but they keep it a secret. They also know that neither is true, and that both weave their mirrors as loosely as spider webs. They'd be shocked if the webs could reflect the extravagance of a clear sky. But they do, a reflection broken by more ripples than words to describe water. In the words of an old saying, the lake shifts its eyes in light of the hill. Shifting the alphabet is chancy, like the judicial system of a virus. How soon vapor driven by chance forgets. The gift of speech is soon followed by remainders of debris. The creature remains hopeful, only to hear an old echo on the tundra. I am your voice, and I have your vote. Once again, frostbitten trees as old as thieving birds warbling their flight. Even echoes of song aren't the best antiseptic. But then, isn't all life sacrosanct, so to speak? Thus embellished with disease, warriors would like to be able to say they understand their spoils, that what they really want to fathom, they killed in battle. Does it take being startled by the ghosts of a lonely childhood to make a start? Ghosts that feel their way along a rope dividing the big sea? Does the big sea spawn punctual clouds drifting toward their little pond? Is the little pond not to be found? Does it take releasing the ropes to step conditional steps toward home, though trackers keep fixing home to an unreassuring block? Does it take closing one's eyes to see the old street strung with alphabetical moorings? Does it take unmooring the street, one's eyes, mute mountains? I said I was happy, but that was an interpretation. The wide-eyed bride runs through time zones and into wheels of daily attention, thinking false green thoughts dancing for rain beneath patchy clouds, all the while loathing elements, the elements on transient principle and pleasuring half-blind rules governing uncontrollable names. An interpretation of happy. There's so many things in nature that are happening all around us that we don't perceive. There are such, you know, tiny or large movements. They don't happen on our scale. And this one sort of explores that idea in a sort of a haiku-like sonnet. Twigs with tiny variations bob against the blue. No gunshot, no sprint. Earth murmurs on its axis, volume turned off. No hearts beating to drums. Seeds hook animal fur. No countdown, but a desert blossoming between 1 and 0. Droplets fed by tiny catastrophes dangle from twigs. A word is lost. Ruddy-cheeked cherubs flutter up a filament rising from the center of a compass. Weather systems with their odious troughs and frontal depressions shape continents. Not lost its way, vanished. Heaven is supposedly at the end of the thread. One raindrop more finds its puddle, or less isn't missed by moths. One word less to describe the precise iridescence of their wings. The filament was imagined, and so were the cherubs. One trifling subtraction, and the keystone evaporates. Catastrophic detour. Heaven's architecture crumbles. No limitless blue skies, but a tempest lost. I raided a lot of different texts for this book, and one of them was my dream journals. and this one came from that source. The levee of the Mississippi, high as a mountain ridge. The path, slippery, laced with puddles. How small, human-sized, the vast river seems from this vantage point. How ironic it'd be, drowning in a puddle, imagining the undertow of the Mississippi. The levee slopes down closer to the banks. I'm astonished to see kittens delicately leaping onto the river and padding with dry paws on diaphanous sheets thrown onto the rippling current. Mysterious hands gently flap the sheets over the water and float them for the kittens, hordes of them now arriving at the shore, deftly bounding onto the cloth spread by unknown hands. From a helicopter at night, an aerial view of a city. In the dark, gigantic iron statues loom with an ominous aura of permanence. The people who live in the city obsess about the possibility of doomsday erupting among their soaring buildings and effigies. Of the end, they've made a fetish, chatting about it at cocktail parties, as if it were the latest vogue. They believe that it could happen at any moment, so they no longer bother to make their beds in the morning. As soon as I moved up to Toronto, the snow and the ice started, you know, creeping into the pollens. And this one is sort of my urban snow poem. Snow, repeat, flesh of snow, fox in tarnished snow, snow of lust, snow of cash, blathering Omega's travesty of dust, snow breaking vows of poverty but not silence, snow of theft, sparrows buried in snow. I'll read how's the time? Five more minutes or so?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, right.
Okay, well, a double sonnet, and then I'll end with another optimistic sonnet about spring. The focal point is off somewhere, sails propelled by the buzz of cicadas, headed who knows where, leaving behind heavy gears grinding to keep a cloud of gnats afloat in thin air. How blank, whispers the sun, swept into the undertow such thoughts of absence lead to. The empty hold echoes with voices from the last conversation. How clever we are, inventing land, mapping every shadow. Was that really you guiding the flotilla into a storm? The drowned sun envies a rick's future melting wax into frozen waterfalls. What is the evidence of rain? The cicadas picture silver fronds shooting spores onto forest floors. Blue they will have the floors, and there begins the crescendo of errors tilting the map's land until barns, candlesticks, streets, gullies, animals start sliding toward the ocean into impermanence. The ship sails into a storm as witnessed. The cicadas and the voices are deep in conversation. The sun glides along the current to the other side of the globe. The map of the earth zooms in past clouds and V formations to a pool where a girl emerges from chlorinated water. She turns her body toward the sun and dries herself. And I'll end with this sonnet about spring. You know how in spring you, well, of course you start experiencing things, you know, essentially that you haven't experienced before after the dull ache of winter. And the things that sort of something, there's always kind of a little thread that leads you into the poem. And for this poem was hearing a dog bark on the street. And I said, wow, you don't hear that really in wintertime somehow. Dogs just don't bark on the streets in wintertime. So it's kind of exotic. Spring's blind surge awakens rambling epics. Evidence gushes. First thing jockey for position. Feet sink into mud. And revelation looms at the cost of sleep. Even a car sounds different. The exotic bark of a dog shatters Orion, spilling sand from a stunned hourglass. Thereafter, molecules relax, and history tries again. A garlanded mother emerges playing a kithara as her darlings weave a pedestal, the better to adore the quixotic colorist. Proof that sensory deprivation binds minions to a redundant deity. Lids can't filter catastrophic light. Sap's light quickens, guiding moments trickling toward a slack horizon. And again, over the years, weep scullions at their skinned rabbits. Peddlers of risk lean into showers of delinquent buds. Thank you all so much for coming.